Okay, so let us start off the evening with the remaining questions from last night and then see what happens. Okay. Okay, so, dear Ajahn, it was the Danish monk Venerable Jnanadipa who has spent 42 years in a forest in Sri Lanka, according to Venerable Nisarno. Venerable Nisarno met him several times. Yes, I know of this monk. In fact, in BSWA DVD, there is a narration by Venerable Nisarno with photos of that monk. We also have that monk up in the Dhanasala at the monastery as well. We have both him and Venerable Nyanavimala are up there. In the same DVD, Ajahn Pamali and Bhattasujato tells a short clip about their spiritual journey. This DVD will be available at the end of the retreat. Okay, that's very nice. In fact, there is another DVD on the spiritual journeys of the nuns as well. Okay, wow, so all there. Bit of advertisement on the events to come. Okay, okay. Very good, that's great. Yeah. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in the simile of the masterless boat tossing and turning on a stormy sea has got me a bit worried. Okay, really? I have immense confidence in the path, but I'm at the very early stage. How do I ensure that the boat stays on the correct path over a lifetime? Thank you. Okay, yes, and that the idea there is precisely this idea of making sure that you, and this is what I'm talking about, getting the wind from the right direction, and that the wind, of course, is the, and the currents, that is the teaching of the Buddha. So all you have to do is to make sure you get good Dhamma teachings all the time. Read a bit of suttas, hear some nice teachings from some people who you respect, right, who you feel know something about the Dhamma, who interpret the teachings in a reasonable way, and find your inspiration there. And this is how you stay the course. And this is why this idea of the good spiritual friend, the Kalyanamitta, is said to be 100% of the holy life. Because without that support, without that thing which drives you in the right direction, supports in the right direction, there is nothing inherent inside of us that gives us direction in life. So just keep on doing that. And if you keep on doing that, you should be fine. Yeah, and as you go along, you investigate for yourself. You see if it actually works, if it gives rise to some of these qualities that the Buddha is promising us. And if things are working out nicely and it gives rise to those things, and then you, as you go along, your commitment will increase and you will start to get more and more faith and confidence in these amazing teachings. Okay, dear Ajahn, I am a lawyer. I am duty bound to protect my clients' interests. There have been situations where telling the whole truth would have been a betrayal of my client's trust. In such a situation, I still say only truthful things, but I omit the things that would hurt my client. Many would say that it is a lie by omission. what do you think? It is very hard. It depends on the situation, right? It depends on what is expected of you. It depends on many things. I guess maybe what you're talking about here is perhaps a trial situation or something like that, and where the judge is asking you to say things as they are. It's difficult, you know. I can't really judge anyone for what they're supposed to, for how they're supposed to live their lives. You have to feel it out for yourself, what feels right and what feels wrong in that kind of situation. But obviously, if your client, it's always dodgy, isn't it? If you are a lawyer for a criminal, for example, and you kind of hide the criminal's kind of activities, you don't tell the truth about those things and all this kind of stuff. It's always a little bit on the edge. So I think as a lawyer, and if I was a lawyer for a criminal, of course I have no idea about these things, but if I was to do something like that, I would focus more on the compassion side of things. I think that is what we need to focus on in our society. We put too much blame into people's hands because we believe that we are all autonomous agents in our lives to do things out of our own free will. But if we understood more in our society about conditioning, we would have far more compassion for each other. And this is what I think perhaps we should bring out in trials, right? We'll say, well, yes, my client made a mistake, he did this and that, but that's life. People make mistakes. Don't be too hard on him. And maybe, you know, does that work? So I think a bit more kind of a bit more Buddhist ideas would be great to have in the criminal law. So anyway, I don't know how you would do this, but obviously you have to try to find some kind of middle way there, what is appropriate in these things. I don't really know enough about the legal situation to be able to give you any good advice on that one. Sometimes it's hard, right? Especially in lay life. You have so many different things kind of pulling you one way and that way. It's very difficult to find a balance sometimes. Even as a monastic, occasionally can be hard, but in lay life, much more difficult. So I don't envy you those difficult decisions to make. Anyway, so let's try another one, see if we can do better on that one. Dear Ajahn, firstly, thank you for being a wonderful teacher. Okay, my meditation is going great. Great guns under your direction here. Okay, that's wonderful. So there is so much I need to learn. Do you recommend a particular translation of the suttas? I know Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote a great version, parts of which I have read. Yes, so that's basically what we're reading here as well, is basically Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, because I personally think he is number one as far as translations are concerned. Will we be seeing the best of Brahmali version that is spoken about in some sentences of the Beatles' White Album, Pink Floyd, I don't know. Okay. We love metta and high fives as well. That's pretty good. Okay. So I have actually translated quite a few of the Pali things, but mostly I have focused on the monastic law and that sort of stuff. But we have another very close friend of the monastery who you may know, Ajahn Sujato. He's actually in the middle of translating the suttas now. He's staying in a small island off Taiwan, and all he does is translate suttas pretty much. And he's getting very close to finishing the four Nikayas. I think the language that he uses is very nice, very simple language, nothing too fancy. This is one of the problems sometimes. You get someone like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi doing translations. He's a philosopher, right? And philosophers, they are kind of, he has a PhD in philosophy. And of course, if you have that kind of, you're used to sort of highfalutin language. And you know, sometimes you have to have your dictionary with you to understand what he's saying here. But I think Ajahn Sujato's translation are going to be much more accessible. And a lot of people these days around the Buddhist world who read the suttas in English, they have English as their second language, right? Like many of the monks in our monastery have English as a second language. I presumably have English as my second language, even though these days I'm not sure what is my second language anymore, but it's kind of, these things change over a lifetime. But so, and because of that, I think it is very important that we make the suttas accessible, easy to read, so everybody can understand it. You don't have to use complicated language to translate the suttas. Sometimes you read it in Pali, and the Pali is very straightforward and simple, and you get the English translation, it's much more complicated. So maybe you should learn Pali, every one of you, and then you can maybe read these suttas. But I think also it is always going to be useful to listen to a teacher who has a lot of experience with the suttas and listen to that, because you cannot get everything into the translation anyway. It's impossible. You have to draw out the meaning. You have to draw out the consequences of these sayings and show them in relationship to other aspects of the teaching. Only that, then, do you really get the full benefit of reading the suttas. So I think it's always beneficial to listen to an experienced teacher, because you will gain a lot from that. I think these suttas retreats, this is, I think, I don't know anyone else who does sutta retreats quite in this way. This is my kind of niche when it comes to retreats, doing suttas and meditation at the same time. It is actually very popular around wherever I go in the world. People really like these kind of retreats. So that's what I would recommend. But be on the lookout for Ajahn Sujata's translation. They're going to come up on suttacentral.net. Suttacentral.net. They're not available quite yet, but within the next year or two, they probably will be available. Yeah. Dear Ajahn, isn't it a good idea for us participants to use one cup and one plate, or one cup and a bowl for our meals? It will save water and washing. Monks and nuns use only one bowl. Suggest, please. Okay, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. So, I guess you don't use too many plates. So if you find yourself having a big stack of plates after the meal, then maybe you have used too many. So be a good idea to be a little bit frugal. But at the same time, if people use a couple of plates, that's okay, because people are different. We have all different ideas, and we are different backgrounds and different conditioning. Have that sense of care and a sense of appreciation of all your fellow people who are here, because everyone who is here is really the creme de la creme, right, when it comes to people. It doesn't get much better than this. It's really, these people are really worth having very high regards for everyone here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, if it might be okay to break a precept depending on one's intention, why does the Buddha say in the Suttava Sutta, Anguttara 9.7, that it is impossible for an enlightened monk to intentionally deprive a living being of life, or for that matter, to break any of the five precepts? This sutta seems to imply that it is impossible to kill with 100% pure intention, since it is possible for an enlightened monk to kill intentionally. Have I misunderstood somehow the Suttava Sutta? That is a good question. Is it possible to kill, or maybe, to do assisted suicide or euthanasia even with 100% pure intentions? It's a very hard question to really answer. There is two possible understandings of this particular sutta, and one is that when you break the precept, it is understood that you're breaking it for a bad reason. So the motivation is understood to be bad when we talk about these things. That is one way of understanding that. So if you have a good intention, by default, you're not actually breaking that precept. That is one way of looking at it. At the time of the Buddha, there were some monastics who committed suicide and who seemed to have been arahants, or very close to arahantship. And if you commit suicide, you are killing a being, right? You're killing yourself. And yet the Buddha said that those monastics were not to blame. They were blameless, which seems to imply that it was acceptable. So that is one way of looking at it, the fact that it is implied that you're coming from a bad motive if you break these precepts. Another one is what you are saying here, is that maybe an arahant is incapable of doing it because the intentions are so pure. And if your intentions are 100% pure, then maybe it is impossible to do these acts. That's another possibility here. For most of us, we are not really striving yet for 100% pure intentions. If we can get to 90%, wow, that is already incredibly powerful. Even 60% is good. 90%, far, far better. So don't aim too high at the beginning, because you're aiming for the impossible sometimes. Okay, so those were the remnants from yesterday. So now let us move on to today's question. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, well, this handwriting is almost like printing. That's pretty cool, yeah. Oh, okay, now I know who it is. Okay, if you could kindly clarify on whether, besides mindfulness, on the appropriate amount of food, there is such a thing as being mindful of the type of food one eats, because certain foods can give rise to certain unwholesome thoughts. Spicy foods to ill will, sweet and oily foods to desire, etc., which can hinder one's progress in meditation. I have heard two stories being told me by a certain monk in a certain meditation center on the matter, but I'm not sure whether its source is from the suttas or commentaries. Thank you for clarifying with metta and gratitude. Okay, so, and these stories are as follows. If I remember correctly, the story one, the Buddha gave advice as to suitable kind of food for a group of monks who's having difficulty in the meditation. A highly attained female devotee prepared a special kind of food for a monk, knowing that the monk would not succeed in his meditation due to unsuitability of the food. Okay, so the Buddha doesn't say very much at all about the kinds of food in the suttas. As far as I can recall, I cannot really remember anything apart from the amount. It is bhojana matanyuta is the Pali word used in the suttas, and matanyuta means knowing the measure in regard to food. That's literally what it means. Bhojana matanyuta. And that is really, as far as I know, all he says. And of course, there are certain rules for monastics. For example, you're not supposed to eat raw garlic, for example. And there's a story in the Vinaya, in the monastic discipline. And the monks are sitting there, and there's one monk sitting far away from the other monks. Right? And the Buddha asks him, why is that monk sitting so far away here? Oh, because he's eaten garlic. So he's we can't bear kind of his breath, so he's sitting far away here. Okay, so no raw garlic anymore. That was kind of one of the rules that was laid down by the Buddha. But generally speaking, there is very little advice on this. So I suspect this actually comes from later in the suttas. I must admit, I have never really felt any of this. You know, whether if I eat spicy food, do I get really a lot of ill will when I eat spicy food? I don't think so. I think spicy food, actually, I quite like spice, a little bit of spicy food. I don't mind that so much at all. I'm very different from Ajahn Brahm in that respect. So I don't know. But of course, the point here is just to be aware of how these things work for you. So just be aware whether these things have a bad effect on you or not, whether the commentaries are right about this or not. Maybe in certain situations this could be true. But generally speaking, the Buddha doesn't say anything about this. So I think it is a matter of personal experience. So just watch and see how the food works for you. That is, I think, the most important thing here. And then work from that pragmatic and practical approach rather than to work from ideas that may not be true for everyone. That is what I would recommend. Okay, so good luck with that one. Okay, two nights ago you said we are our own judges determining the destination of our rebirth. Isn't it true that some people tend to overestimate themselves while some others tend to be harsher on themselves? This doesn't seem right to me. Please enlighten Ajahn. Okay, bang, enlightenment. No, okay. It would be nice if it was that easy. It is true that some people overestimate themselves, some people have kind of big egos, some people underestimate themselves, right? Some are harsher on themselves, some are gentle on themselves. We vary a lot. And of course, these things also are part of karma, part of our habits. So if you are harsh on yourself, it probably has some relation to how you have developed your mind in the past in a certain way. So this will, of course, it will affect your karma to some extent and where you get reborn. But I also think that when you come to your, you know, when you are passing away, you are about to die, I think it is slightly different from the ordinary way that we judge ourselves. Because it's more like a third person. Look, you are seeing your life as a third person. It's like you're watching a movie and you're seeing yourself doing all of these things, just as if you're seeing somebody else, right? So you're almost judging yourself in a third person. That's how my understanding how this works. And because of that, it is not so much about harshness and about ourselves, because you're seeing yourself as almost like, as if you are somebody else. So because of that, I think it is more of a neutral kind of judgment that you have at that time when you pass away. Yes, I agree with you. There probably is some degree of variation there, depending on your character and all of these kind of things. And one of the interesting things about the suttas is that, you know, the Buddha has this very famous simile of the grain of salt, which many of you would have heard about before. You put a grain of salt in a glass of water, it becomes undrinkable. Put the same grain of salt in a large body of water, you can barely taste the saltiness. So the salt is the bad karma, the amount of water is the good karma, and the saltiness is the result, the amount of result it has. So if you have a character, you have not developed yourself very much, a small bad act can have tremendously bad consequences for you. But if you have developed your character a lot and you have gone a long way on the spiritual path, done a lot of goodness in your life, then the same amount, the same bad karma is barely experienced by you at all. No results at all. So it varies enormously on your character, right? And of course, the people who have more ability to forgive themselves are precisely the people who tend to have created more good karma, either in this life or in past lives. So this is a very strong good incentive to create, another incentive to create lots of good karma, because it's easier to let go of the past and all dilute all the bad stuff that you have done, which is a wonderful thing to happen. I hope that helps. Okay. Dear Ajahn, there are five methods to overcome thoughts. Yeah, is there something similar to deal with negative judgmental perception and negative feelings with metta? It is very similar, right? If you are judgmental and you have negative perception, negative feelings, these things tend to end up as negative thoughts. It's very difficult to have negative perceptions and not those perceptions ending up as negative thoughts somehow. So it is a similar kind of thing. If you have negative perception or you're judgmental about others, again, you learn to look at the other side of them. Yeah, you start to look at those things which are positive. And when you see the positive things, your perception of that person changes. You see the good side, you think, wow, actually, they're not so bad. Actually, they have all this good side. Why am I fault-finding so much with them when they have all these good qualities? Yeah, and slowly you change your attitude towards them. Your perception changes, less judgmental, more accepting, more understanding that human beings are human beings. And very often, we just... everyone suffers more than they want to. Everyone has more problems in life than they want to. Whether you are male or female, whether you are Australian, Norwegian or Singaporean, whether you are whatever monk, monastic or layperson, right? It's true across the board. And when you see that, you can have more compassion. This is why the Buddha has he has the Maha Karuna, which means the great compassion, because he can really see the problems in the world. We can see how everybody is affected by far more suffering than they really want to have. Life is always has more difficulties than we would like. Nobody wants more difficulties. Nobody wants to break a leg if they don't have to, right? Nobody wants to be depressed if they don't have to. Nobody wants to be sad if they don't have to. Everybody wants more happiness if possible. That's what I reckon anyway, but it kind of seems right. So remember that, and then build up that perception. Try to understand people. Give them the benefit of the doubt. See the suffering in others. Know that life is never easy for anyone. And then have compassion. Have that care, that gentleness, that tenderness towards other people. And it's very, very beautiful for your own meditation practice when you do that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, sometimes sensations of pulsating of body, maybe from the heart area, from the tummy, is this distraction to be discarded or to be observed like the breath? Sometimes sensation of pulsating of the body, maybe from the heart area, from the tummy. Okay, these things are... probably no problem at all. It's probably just sensations coming, arising, and then sensations sort of hopefully disappearing again after a while. So if you are, depending on exactly what you are doing, I don't know what you're doing at this time, maybe you're watching the breath or whether you are kind of just chilling and relaxing and trying to kind of just enjoy the present moment or whatever it is. Just stay with whatever you're doing. Don't worry too much about those things. Leave those things aside. And very often they're just temporary perceptions that arise and then disappear again after a while. Don't focus too much on them. Sometimes if you focus on them, they can become a bit obsessive and they can become worse, but just allow them to be and stay with the present moment, stay with the breath or whatever it is. If it becomes very intense and it's kind of starting to worry you a little bit, then of course, then maybe open your eyes and take a walk outside or something. But generally speaking, there's nothing really to worry about with these things. So just keep carry on and just enjoy what you are doing already, and you should be fine. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, how do we reconcile the importance of having the perception of joy and happiness with the reality of suffering, impermanence, and non-self? I'm confident I will be happy with your answer, but still be suffering. Okay, ooh, that's okay. So this answer is going to be a kind of a slightly dubious, both joy and suffering at the same time. Okay, so how do we reconcile this? And the way you reconcile this is to understand that these ideas of impermanence and suffering, these are a profound insight on the Buddhist path. They are not just about kind of the feelings that we have in the present moment. They are about insight into the nature of existence. So seeing suffering is very different from feeling joy. Feeling joy, of course, that is joyful. You can't really deny that feeling joy is joyful. That is happiness. But the insight into suffering doesn't really turn the joy into suffering, but it gives you a broader picture of what life is about. And that is what it does. So we should always cultivate the positive feelings. We should always enjoy our life to the maximum in this way. Enjoy the meditation to the maximum and all of these kind of things. And seeing suffering is more like, for example, you see the impermanence of joy here. You see how you cannot ultimately rely on that joy because you can't control it. It will eventually disappear again. That is what seeing suffering is about, because you understand that all of these things are limited and out of your control. But actually seeing that suffering, this is the paradox, seeing that suffering is itself happiness. This is a weird kind of thing. When you understand suffering fully, wow, so happy. It sounds like you would be really depressed, right? Oh, so much suffering. No, you feel really happy about that. And this is that famous saying that Ajahn Brahm talks about. There was I think it's a statue of Ajahn Shah or something. It has this writing on the bottom. No, not Ajahn Shah. Ajahn Buddhadasa, I think, one of the famous teachers in Thailand. At the bottom it has, joy at last to know that there is no happiness in the world. It sounds like a paradox. Joy at last to see that everything is suffering. What do you mean, joy at last to see everything is suffering? For us, it's kind of incomprehensible. But because what is meant here by suffering is slightly different from how we normally understand it. So don't allow yourself to be depressed by these things. Sometimes people think, oh, everything is suffering. Wow, that's really depressing. But that is kind of completely the wrong way to understand these things. If you understand suffering in the right way, it is actually a release, because you are suddenly moving in a different direction, leaving all the suffering behind. And you feel happy when you see that. So please don't allow yourself to be depressed by these Buddhist teachings. That would be terrible. Enjoy all the happiness on the path. And this is one of the beautiful things about the Buddhist teaching. There is so much happiness to be had on the Buddhist path, so much joy, so much contentment, so much profundity in so many different ways. And this is what kind of, makes this path so beautiful. And it's kind of weird, isn't it, that on the one hand, Buddhism is about all this happiness, and then it's also about insight into the suffering. But the two actually are just two sides of the same coin. Every time you feel joy, the reasons why you're feeling joy is because you have left some suffering behind. You meditate, the body disappears, and whoa, what happiness for the body to disappear. The body is this, there's so much trouble and pain with the body. It's so nice when it's just gone. The less there is, the happier you are. The more stuff disappears, the better you feel about it. And eventually you see suffering fully and you feel even more happiness and joy as a consequence. It's kind of it's an interesting path, isn't it? It seems so kind of contradictory in many ways. So are you happy with the answer? Or are you suffering with the answer? This is the question. Anyway, so that's just some. This is roughly how it works. So hope that is satisfactory at least. Whether it's happiness or suffering, don't know, but at least it's satisfactory. Okay. Dear Ajahn, when I meditate, I often feel a tension in my forehead. It usually happens on retreat when I meditate much more than usually. Could you please tell what could be the reason and what to do about it? If I try to focus my attention on my forehead to relax it, then tension gets stronger. Thank you. Gratitude for all your wonderful Dhamma teachings. Okay, so usually the reason why you get tensions and people sometimes get headaches and this kind of things, it is because you are using too much force in your meditation practice. You're trying too hard. You are forcing your attention onto the breath or whatever it is, and then tension can arise as a consequence. There's a well-known fact that many people get what they call samadhi headaches, right? And this is kind of samadhi. It's kind of the wrong kind of samadhi, the samadhi we are trying too hard. And this is why it is so important to learn to relax, to allow these things to come as naturally as possible. Sit back and just wait. Don't do anything, yeah? And usually what people do, they sit down and straight away they grab onto the breath. Okay, I got the breath. And this is problematic, right? Because that whole idea of grabbing on means force. And sometimes we are so used to using force in our lives, we don't even realize that we're doing it. It doesn't even feel very much like force. So this is why you have to learn to go in the opposite direction. Sit back, relax, enjoy. Just enjoy the peace, enjoy the good company, enjoy being at Jhana Grove, right? Wow, this is such a wonderful meditation center. It's one of the, you know, it's so peaceful. The nature is so beautiful out here. And this week has been some of the most beautiful days I've seen in a long time, just one after the other. Wow, it's like magic almost. And you get into that magical feeling and you feel happy about that. Yeah, and then you just relax. Take it easy. Don't do anything. Don't watch the breath. Give up the breath. You're never going to watch the breath for the rest of your life. That's the attitude, yeah? And just enjoy. And then suddenly the breath comes to you, and you know now is the right time to watch it. So try those kind of things. Don't focus on your forehead, because as you say, that can make it stronger, because you're just attending again with force to whatever is going on. So try it out and see what happens. Okay, mega meta to the kind person who on Tuesday put a written note on my lap pointing to the interview time still being available. It resulted in a most helpful interview with Ajahn Ramali and with the Venerable Akaliko watching on there. Okay, so that's good. So sadhu for that. Number two, if anybody needs help with death meditation, I recommend a walk in the gardens between cottages 5 to 10 and the pond where you can find the carcass, mostly bones, of a kangaroo. Great visual aid. Okay, so if you want to see the carcass of a kangaroo between cottages 5 and 10, so that would be over there somewhere, is that right? 1, 2, 3, is over there? Not sure. Not sure exactly where it is. It's somewhere around here. So find that carcass. Thank you, Ajahn, for your teachings, especially going over the same sutta as again. Most helpful and inspiring. Okay, that's a very nice note and very positive. So that's really, thank you for that. Okay. In explaining the sutta this morning, you described sati sampajanya acting first to catch that a bad thought had arisen, then using yonasimanasikara to contemplate how the thoughts lead to affliction, etc., and thereby abandoning it. In the sutta of the day on ignorance, however, the yonisomanasikara comes first, is the cause for sati sampajanya to arise. So it can work either way. Yes, these things are very closely related to each other, right? And you can say in one hand that yonisomanasikara leads to the arising of sati. You need a certain amount of right attention to have mindfulness in the first place. Or you can say that the sati sampajanya arises, and then based on that mindfulness, you then have further yoniso manasikara. And this is the idea that yoniso manasikara, the right attention, is something you take with you on the entire path. From the moment you first time hear about the Buddhist teaching and think, wow, this is really good stuff. At that moment, you have your first moment of yoniso manasikara. And you take it with you all the way till you reach awakening here. So this is one of those things. So these factors are not absolutely set in concrete how they work with each other. They can often work. The conditioning is often mutual, and they work both ways often. Can you walk us through an example where yoniso manasikara acts first? So yoniso manasikara acting first is, for example, you start off right with listening to the teachings of the Buddha. You hear the teachings, you gain faith and confidence, like it's said in that sutta called the Avijja Sutta. And then based on that, you start practicing. You start practicing virtue, the five precepts. That is, in a sense, already yoniso manasikara, because you are applying yourself to doing something which is good. So that would be yoniso manasikara, the practicing the virtue, the basic virtue on the path. Then, because that basic virtue on the path, mindfulness becomes more powerful. And then, based on that mindfulness, you have more powerful yoniso manasikara after that, and use that to overcome not just the bad acts of body and speech, but also the mental bad actions at the same time. So you can see how they interrelate, they interweave in this way here. Actually, all three seem to overlap. Sense restraint. Can you explain a bit more the difference and the relationship between them? Thank you. Thank you very much. So, sense restraint is really the use of all of these things, right? Sense restraint means that you are using sati. Sati is the guard that allows you to know whether you are restraining or not. So sati is like is always required to tell you whether you're heading in the right direction or what's going on. Sampajanya is then the idea of whether what you're doing is appropriate or not. Sati tells you, okay, I'm thinking a thought of kindness. And then Sampajanya says, yeah, good, you're heading in the right direction, no need to do anything more, you're already on the right track. Sati tells you, I'm complaining about somebody. Sampajanya says, okay, no good, this is not going to be useful, heading in the wrong direction. And then, based on that fact that you're heading in the wrong direction, you ask yourself, how can I think about this differently? And then yoniso manasikara gives you the tool, gives you the way, grabs that perception off the shelf, right? And says, this is the perception to use now. And if you use that perception in the right way and it overcomes the problem, then yoniso manasikara has worked. All of these things come together. And that is, that whole package is sense restraint. That whole package of using wisdom, using the mindfulness to guard the mind, and then moving in the right direction. That is what is meant by sense restraint. And interesting, it is all about the wisdom, right? The yoniso manasikara, being wise about these things. So that is one way of explaining it, but this can be explained in many ways. That is just kind of what kind of comes to mind to me as the obvious way, and I think maybe perhaps the mainstream way according to the suttas. But these things can be kind of bolted together in various ways. But in all of these instances, sati, mindfulness, is like the basic thing that you require. Without the sati, then there's no hope of kind of having any kind of restraint or anything else. Sati, awareness, has to be there. Okay. Well, you guys are really good at asking questions, I have to say, which is which actually is very nice. I really, really appreciate that. So, dear Ajahn, number one, thank you for the wonderful teachings. It would be nice if there were more refined translations can be available to us. Okay, they're coming, right? So watch out on suttacentral.net and they will arrive eventually here. How do you deal with neither wholesome nor unwholesome? How do you deal with that? Do I basically, most of the time, you just ignore it? because a lot of our life is about that, right? We just do things that need to be done, and it is neither one nor the other very much. But what you can do is you can sometimes put wholesomeness into those things that are neutral, right? Instead of just, as I was saying the other day, instead of just going to work and kind of laboring through the day in a kind of meaningless fashion, you put some positivity into what you're doing. Put some metta into what you're doing. Put some kind thoughts to your fellow workers, your customers, and the whole world. I'm doing this to help the world be a better place, right? At least I'm going to do my work well. Every job has your little, we are all little wheels in a big machinery. And if our wheel kind of works, does the job well, we're helping the whole machinery of the world to work better. You know, it is important for the world to function in a certain way. All of these things are what ultimately gives us food on the plate and all of this kind of stuff. So thinking about every little thing in a positive way is very useful. When the mind becomes more powerful, will there be any physical signs? For example, heated, fever, pulsating in the head, etc., difficulty to sleep, and those kind of things. Will there be any physical signs when the mind becomes more powerful? Well, one of the obvious signs, it's not so much physical, it's mostly just internal, right? You know about these things when your mind becomes powerful and you become more awake, you know what's going on. Yes, there can sometimes be more difficulty in falling asleep. Sometimes you don't even want to fall, you don't want to go to sleep. You just stay awake. So you sit here in the meditation hall when everybody else is gone, you're the last person who sits in here, and you just enjoy it so much. And that can sometimes happen, and you have a few hours of sleep, and you get up again, and then you are still full of energy. This is one of the kind of main things. Mostly it's internal. You often cannot really tell so much externally about these things. You become very peaceful, right? You feel very peaceful inside of yourself. The body becomes much more easygoing, much more relaxed. If anything, there is less heat, less fever, less pulsating. The body is very balanced usually once the meditation becomes deeper. So it's more like you are more relaxed, and there's less kind of problems of any type really. And you're just very content, very happy. You have almost no problems anymore. You can see the problems in life fading away, right? Things becoming easy. Life becoming like just dancing around and really enjoying yourself. So if we see you dancing around, we know that you're doing really well. Okay, so great. So thank you very much for the refined translations. Really make a difference. Okay, wonderful. So, dear Ajahn, if you are teaching someone new to meditation, would you still advise them to sit back, relax, and wait? Or would you advise them to use a little will to get back to the breath? Is telling a new meditator to do nothing a good idea? I think it can be a good idea, because usually if you tell a beginner to get onto the breath, that guaranteed they will use too much force. But what I would recommend any beginner is always to have a guide. Use guided meditations to get you going, to remind you of what you have to do. And in the early days when you meditate, you need quite intensive guidance, right? You have a guide who tells you, kind of brings you back to reality every few minutes, because you haven't really got a clue what's going on or what you're supposed to do. So more intensive guidance when you start off. Sit back, relax. Okay, relax, take it easy, enjoy, be aware, be the passenger, be the passive observer, yeah? All of these things. And then you gradually get into that mindset, get into that idea of how that works. One of the great things to do in the early days is to also to do, I would rather recommend to do metta meditation in the early days, and use your mind to do metta. Because it gives you something to do if you have a restless mind. Right, you sit back, you visualize the directions, you wish all beings in those directions, you wish them well, may all the beings in the north, you visualize all these people with really good qualities, generous, kind, may you all be happy and well. And it gives you a little bit to do in your meditation practice, which can be useful. And then as you get the hang of it, you start to become just more, sit back, relax, and enjoy her. The most important thing in life for anyone who starts out on the Buddhist path is just to have to be kind, right? Sometimes we emphasize meditation a lot in Buddhism, but far more important than meditation is actually our attitude to life, our kindness, the quality of our character. That is what really matters. That is by far the most important thing here. Meditation comes out of that. So if you should give anyone some real advice on what Buddhism is about, then the kindness of the heart is far, far more important. Everything else arises out of that. And the meditation that we do in daily life should really be something that supports our virtue, our morality, our kindness, our character development. That is what it should do. If it does that, it will have a very long term, be very beneficial for you. But really, it is, and this is one of the things that I've been talking about already quite a bit, is that the foundation for meditation, for mindfulness, for samadhi, everything else, is sila, right? Your character, that is the foundation. Everything else is really not so important. So that is what we have to do, deal with. That's what we have to change. That's what we have to develop. Okay, dear Ajahn, two kinds of thoughts. I feel like I have 15 or more. Okay. Where did I leave my shawl? How should I rearrange the furniture in my room? Stray thoughts about the latest celebrity gossip. These aren't thoughts that clearly fall under sense desire, ill will, or ruthlessness, or the opposite. Or are they all just thought connected with confusion, as per Majjhima Nikaya 20? A lot of them are actually about these things, but you have to fill in the dots here, because you have to understand how these things work. So when you think about your shawl, right? Where did I put my shawl? Well, the reason why you think about that is perhaps because you are a little bit cold. So if you are cold, that is a kind of sensual thing. Yeah, you feel the cold and you're worried about that. You want to be warm. Or maybe you are afraid of losing your shawl. Where did I put my shawl? What happened to it? That is also a sensual thing, because you are attached to that object to some extent. That's why you worry about what happened to it. So they are actually connected to these things. You just have to connect the dots to see how these things work. Yeah, and the same thing about rearranging your furniture. Definitely, that is a kind of sensual thought. Furniture in your house, right, is important to us. That it is right, that kind of feels good, and all of this kind of stuff. That is certainly related to sensuality. Remember, when we talk about sensuality in Buddhism, we mean two things. On the one hand, we mean the desire, the personal, subjective desire that we all have. And on the other hand, we also mean the objects of the sensual world. And by the objects of the sensual world, we mean everything in the world that somehow we are attached to or that we desire in one way or another. That's a lot, right? I mean, it's just so much of that stuff. And once you look at it like that, you realize how broad this category of sensual desire is. Incredibly broad. All those objects, all those personal desires are part of that. So, what to do with them? Some of these thoughts are sort of useful, not exactly leading to my affliction. Any thoughts? So what to do with them? To deal with them is to remember that there are more important things in the world than rearranging your furniture, right? This is low on the priority list. Here you are. You have a wonderful opportunity to really chill out, to really enjoy yourself. Forget about that blooming furniture. And you are... Remember, one day you're going to die. You're going to have to give up that furniture anyway. And when you die, what are you going to take with you? Your mind. This is your chance to create a beautiful mind for yourself that you take with you into the far distant future, way beyond this life. That is where you want to invest. That is where you want to invest your time and your resources to creating a beautiful mind for yourself. That furniture is there one day. Next day, it's gone. And it's irrelevant. Those things are completely kind of absolute waste of time, to be honest. Okay, not absolute. There's a little bit kind of a little bit to it. I can see where you're coming from. But generally speaking, it's a waste of time. So that is what to do with that. Remember what is important in life. Remember what to prioritize. Yeah. And remember that here you are much closer to the meaning of life than you are in normal life. Normal life, we kind of run around in a lot of fog and lack of clarity with all kind of thoughts running through our head. Here, hopefully, you're getting a little bit more clarity, a little bit more sense of perspective than you have in your ordinary life. And this is where we're all trying to go. So, see what happens. But these things take time. You have to keep on practicing, keep on contemplating the teachings, keep on listening to the word of the Buddha, keep on coming back to retreats every now and again, and gradually, you go in that direction. Dear Ajahn, I had thought that Buddhism denies the existence of an ultimate creator god. If AN 1061 says only that no first point of ignorance is seen, rather than saying there is no first point, is it still accurate to say that Buddhism denies an ultimate creator god? How does the Buddha leave this question, or does the Buddha leave this question unanswered? It is accurate to say that Buddhism denies an ultimate. It is actually accurate. The very fact that you cannot see a first point means that basically what it means is that you cannot say, nobody can say anything about the beginning. So if you go back as far as you possibly can, the only way you could say anything about the creator god is to go back to the creator god and then say, I've seen the creation. That is the only way you could do that. If all you do is go back and back and back and you see nothing, you certainly cannot conclude that there is a creator god from that. But I guess you are saying one should then be agnostic. That's probably what you're saying. You cannot say one way or the other. But actually you can. And the reason you can do that is because one of the most important things on the Buddhist path, of course, is the insight into impermanence. The understanding of impermanence. And that insight into impermanence is so complete. You know that any experience you can ever have as a human being or any other being is always going to be impermanent. Everything is impermanent. It is impossible to have an experience that is permanent, that is always going to be there. And because that is impossible, it means that you can never see a permanent God. You can never know about a permanent God. A permanent God is outside of experience. And because it is outside of experience, it doesn't exist. Everything that exists is within our experience. Anything outside of experience doesn't exist. If it did exist, it would be completely irrelevant anyway. It's kind of, it is as if it doesn't exist. Experience is what exists. Anything outside of experience does not really exist. So from that insight into the impermanence of things, you can say with certainty that there's such a thing as a permanent God is impossible. That is what you can say. Anything permanent is impossible. Nothing can be permanent in the anywhere in experience. And that is where that comes from, that idea that there is no creator god or permanent god. In fact, the Buddha goes so far, and this is in another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 3, also 61, by the way, where the Buddha says, if we were created by a god, there would be no living of the holy life. Because is that what he says? I think that's what he says in there. I hope I'm not misquoting the Buddha now. Bad karma to misquote the Buddha. So I think that's what he says. If we were created by a creator god, then that creation would then we would be kind of given certain qualities by that god, and because things are not caused by the ordinary causations going back, cause following cause, it means that it would be impossible to practice the holy life in an ordinary way. I believe that's what he says in there. Anyway, maybe I should check it out before I say that. Anyway, so that is the reply. So do maybe one more question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, why is it always easier to pay attention to negative thoughts rather than the positive? I've been trying to contemplate good and bad thoughts and And for the life of me, I can't pin down a single good thought. Ooh. Okay. It's not that I don't have them. I know I have plenty, but pinning them down is quite difficult. Okay. Not sure exactly what you mean by that, but... I don't think it's easier one way or the other. You can't really say it's easy. This is just habits, right? So you have a certain habit, and that's why it is easier to pay attention to the negative thoughts. So it's just a habit, and habits are changeable. Habits are conditioned. That is the wonderful thing about that. This is the beautiful thing about Buddhism, is that everything is conditioned, so everything is changeable. It means we can do stuff with ourselves. We can change our outlook, change our happiness and suffering. If you have been created in God's image, and this is what you are, bang, you are going to suffer so much and be so happy, and there's nothing you can do about it. Then, of course, it's a problem. But the very fact that we do not, according to Buddhism, have selves, we don't have souls, we don't have permanent aspects to our personality, means that we are completely malleable. Everything can be changed. Everything can be turned around. More happiness can always be created. And that is the beautiful side of these teachings, that nothing is set kind of bang in concrete or in soul, nothing is set in a kind of soulhood or whatever you want to call it. Everything is kind of malleable and movable. So just change the way you attend to things. Just change your outlook. Try to remember the goodness inside of yourself. After a while, you will start to see the good qualities much more. And as you practice this path, as you remember these things, gradually, it will grow inside of you. And I think a lot of people actually notice this. When they live the life well, this is exactly what happens. Almost happens automatically by itself. So that's, I'm not sure exactly if that is exactly what you mean, but that is my reply, whether you mean that or not. That is what I'm going to say. So please feel free to ask again if you feel I haven't answered properly. That is perfectly okay. Okay, so that is all for tonight.